materials and turn things over to your official session moderator, Jeff Brewer. So Jeff, whenever you're ready to get started, please do.
Thanks, Gene. Again, I'd like to welcome everybody to the Military Munition Support Services, aka M2S2, Chemical Warfare Material Response Webinar. We will have, as soon as the schedule comes up, or the agenda comes up, you'll see we have three speakers today, so we will not be taking a break in the middle. This webinar should last approximately 2 hours. It was put together by the National Association of Ordnance Contractors, also known as NAOC. So you'll see different contractors' presentations from different projects. And still waiting for the agenda. It should come up here in just about a minute. But again, if you have a question during the presentation, please type it into the Q&A window, and I'll have one of my team members, he will look it over and forward it up to me. And at the end of each presentation, we will read those questions out. If we do not get to your question, such as if time ran a little long, we will have your questions, answer your questions at the end of the presentation. And with that, I think we will just go ahead and go right on into the first presentation. And I guess, Gene, if you can go ahead and pull up Chris's presentation then.
Yes, sir. It's appearing on the screen now.
Oh, I must have a little lag on mine, my end. Anyway, okay, well, I'll introduce our first speaker. It's Chris Denbrack of Parsons. He will be doing a presentation, a comparison of CWM versus conventional mech response operations. And with that, I will turn it over to Chris.
Thanks, Jeff. Good morning or good afternoon, everyone. Again, my name is Chris Denbrack with Parsons. I'm a senior project manager here, been with Parsons 17 years. I started off in the environmental consulting business in the late 80s. My 40-hour training was done in 1989, so you can figure out the math on that one. And in the late 90s, kind of switched over from the traditional HTW investigation world to munitions response. And then in about 2001, started doing CWM work within the munitions world. So with that, we'll dive into an overview. And this is kind of a 10,000-foot overview of the differences and similarities between conventional mech sites and CWM. Before I advance to the next slide, I just want to give a shout-out to Jeff and James Salisbury. James is with NAOC and coordinated the contractors and working with the M2S2. And I think it's always great when the contractors and private side get to integrate with government. So thanks to James and Jeff for this opportunity. Let's see, advance. There we go. So the agenda, we'll go through some definitions, overall planning for the different sites, different personnel involved, training, fieldwork phases, and then at the end we'll do a summary. On the right is a picture we found a couple years ago, and it's this is a great picture, I think, that at least he's got a respirator on, no other PPE, he's got coveralls, no gloves, but I guess this is how they used to do CWM assessment back in the day. All right, so a couple of definitions. So what is chemical agent? Chemical agent is designed to kill or seriously injure a person. There are different forms of CWM, and you will notice that materiel is spelt with an E. This is not a typo. The military refers to their inanimate objects as materiel. You have personnel and materiel. So you will note that CWM is definitely spelt with an E there, not an A. So different forms of CWM. We have, We have munitions that contain chemical agent, such as this 75-millimeter round over here. It'll often, the fill agent is located within the munition. You'll have a burster, so traditional munition, but filled with chemical agent. You'll also have bulk containers, 55-gallon drums, and what are known as ton containers. Those are known as CWM as well. And occasionally you'll have laboratory bottles, miscellaneous containers that, based on the location, may contain chemical agent. Down in the lower right, you know, there's a photo. This is an unusual-looking glass vial sealed on one end, liquid in it. When we recovered this, the agent or the contents were unknown, so we did additional research. We had to handle this as CWM due to the unknown contents. And occasionally you will have munitions with unknown liquid fills, and that may have been due to testing or whatever, but those initially are handled as CWM. So just as importantly is the flip side, what is not CWM? So currently, CWM does not include riot control agents, herbicides, smokes, flames. Initially, back World War I time frame, a lot of the smoke and flame items were referenced to CWM, but the current definition for CWM does not include those items. There's also a kind of a unique item, the chemical agent identification sets. We'll talk more about those in a little bit, but the certain case sets contain dilute chemical agent or industrial chemicals, and those types of case are not CWM. If you do have an item that is CWM, it must be handled and ultimately disposed of by DOD. So here's a little more discussion on the chemical agent identification sets. These were issued to troop training up until about the mid-1960s. A number of these agent sets did contain dilute chemical agent or industrial chemicals, and those are treated as hazardous waste. Select case, so this is sometimes yes, sometimes no if it's CWM. So certain case contain neat agent. In the lower left, there's a photo of someone holding a jar that says HD on it. So this would have had mustard agent in a neat form. So this particular jar would be handled as CWM, but these types over here contain dilute agent and would be handled as hazardous waste. The reason case is kind of unique is because there were well over 100,000 case sets that were sent out to the troops, so quite a few sites end up having some sort of case or a history of case or some documentation of case being present there. So do you have a CWM site? This document that is shown over here on the right side is kind of the Bible. This is what you should refer to if you think you have a CWM response. You will note the date, April Fool's, 2009. So this document is over 10 years old and is still in draft form, but this is the guidance document that drives all site responses for CWM. Within this document, it identifies kind of the first step, and that is the probability of encountering CWM. The probability assessment is done and signed off by an installation or district commander, and essentially research is done to look at past evidence or physical evidence that if CWM may or may not be present at your particular site. There's a specific procedure to follow in DA PAM 385-30. The different categories are identified here at the bottom. Essentially, you go through the process, and if your site is identified as occasional or higher, so occasional, likely, or frequent probability of encountering CWM, then you have a CWM site. If you do identify a CWM site and it's not stockpile, not treaty related, then Huntsville Center, there's requirement to involve them. They are involved in CWM sites and investigations and response. So it's important to note that some CWM sites, you know, they're also going to have MEC. They may also have HTW, or you may even have all three combined at your site. So as an overview, we'll look at the similarities and differences, project planning, CLAP development, field operations, and then ultimately final reporting and closeout. You'll notice as we go through that the CWM sites require a lot of extra activities, probably is what you're used to seeing on conventional MEC sites. So planning and development. Conventional sites, as you know, we have a CLAP that we have to develop on a conventional site. Same with a CWM site. On conventional sites, we have an ESP and an ESS. Most are familiar with this, NGFD, HFD, MFD. You also often have magazine siting, and then an APP and SSHP. On the CWM site, we have a CSP, which is kind of the equivalent of the ESP, but it also, in addition to dealing with the MGFD and HFD, we develop what's called a maximum credible event. We'll talk more about this in another slide. And then there's a 1% lethality that's generated for an exclusion zone. So there are different things that go into the CSP that are based on air dispersion modeling, an interim holding facility. If you do find CWM, you have to place it in a secure setting. So a little bit more on the front end and work plan CSP development. As you may imagine, the APP and SSHP is much more robust on a chemical site. There are exclusion zones, work zones, decontamination zones, extensive respiratory protection plans, hazard communication, similar to the conventional sites, but much more involved. Emergency response and contingency plans, medical support plans, and radiation plans. This picture here is an X-ray of an item. You can see a liquid line across this particular item. This is one way to do a non-intrusive assessment of CWM. So if you do have X-ray capabilities on site, then you also have to develop a radiation plan. So just a lot of front-end planning goes into it.
Excuse me, Chris,
additional plans.
Chris,
oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Interrupt, but you're doing a lot of acronyms, and we had a couple comments that kind of define what the acronyms are, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right.
So this is a quality assurance project plan, so essentially a work plan, explosive siting plan, explosive siting submission. APP is an accident prevention plan. And then the CSP is a CWM siting plan and a chemical safety submission. Hopefully that covered most. Okay. I'll spell those out going forward. Sorry about that. Thanks for letting me know. So additional other plans for CWM activities include investigation-derived waste plan. We'll talk more about this on a later slide, but there are a lot of different waste streams for a CWM site. There is a standalone interim holding facility plan, and then air monitoring plan. This is developed by a government agency that is known by this great acronym here. So this is Combat Capabilities Development Command, Chemical Biological Center. So the government in all its wisdom has this great acronym. So if you are including this agency on a memo, you have to be sure to CC, CC, DC, CBC. It's a mouthful. Anyway, vulnerability assessments, you coordinate with local police or FBI to see if there are potential threats for recovered CWM, physical security plans, public protection plans. Medical support agreements need to be in place with hospitals, on-site ambulance. We also need to provide a toxic chemical training course for the hospital staff and the on-site ambulance so they are trained in how to handle chemical agent casualties. There is an extensive medical surveillance program for your on-site personnel. There are additional requirements to notify commercial laboratories that samples may contain chemical agent. We will discuss this in more detail in a later slide. And obviously, it's very important to establish exclusion zones, contamination reduction zones, and support zones. Planned egress routes, a lot of maps to how to get through decontamination zones to ambulances. That's all very important, needs to be spelled out. And then there needs to be notification procedures. If there is emergency response required, the public needs to be notified and it needs to identify if they're going to evacuate or shelter in place. So certainly there are a lot of different activities and planning steps to go in before you even start your intrusive investigation. So one of the things I mentioned previously was development of a maximum credible event. This is This is usually done in consultation with the project team, where you look at what the maximum release would be from an unplanned or accidental release. So this isn't necessarily ultimate worst case, but it is a realistic case for release from a munition or chemical agent release in general. It doesn't have to be a munition release. Oh, I'm trying to get my arrow back. There we go. So the maximum credible event looks at an air dispersion model. A common one is called B2PC. It has a number of model inputs down here and across the top here. The model is really used to identify these distances here. The 1% lethality, and that 1% lethality is where 1% of the population would not survive an exposure. And that is typically what your exclusion zone ends up being. And then there's a much greater distance, which is the no significant effects, which you'll often see referenced as the nose distance. And here's an example of some model calculations. And you can see that the no effects distance, depending on the scenario, can go all the way from as little as 39 feet. And then this particular instance, this model run over 3/4 of a mile. So depending on your model inputs and output, your exclusion zones can vary quite a bit depending on the scenarios. Therefore, it's very important that this maximum credible event is identified correctly and agreed upon by the team. When you do have these large exclusion zones, it can be quite costly to implement an exclusion or reduce that exclusion zone with engineering controls. This picture over here, it's in a residential neighborhood. You'll see there's a house right here. The intrusive site is under this containment structure, and then there are all these filtration systems that are hooked up to this. So this gets very costly if you are having to do a site within a residential area such as this. Personnel requirements on a conventional site, we have the senior UXO specialist, the safety officer, and QC officer. On a CWM site, we have the same personnel. You may have geophysics, CWM site, you may have geophysics as well. On a conventional site, you have your intrusive teams, and you certainly can have quite a few intrusive teams and a lot of people on a conventional site. But the thing that's unique about a CWM site is the various different responsibilities for all these teams and personnel. Typically, your intrusive team on a conventional site, they're all doing an intrusive investigation. On a CWM site, you'll have downrange teams, and these are typically your team members that are going downrange to do the intrusive work. But you also have a sample coordinator, because generally you're collecting lots and lots of samples. You'll also have a personnel decontamination station team, and this is staffed by typically at least three persons. You always have a rescue team in place in case there is an emergency. This is a minimum of two persons. There's an air monitoring team, and this is at least four people. And then often there's a package assessment and transport team. And then there's always, during intrusive operation, medics on site with an ambulance, and that's typically two persons there. This I like this photo here, and their PPE. I like this guy appears to be in an old-style leather bomber jacket, but this is how it was done. This is actually a photo taken from a CWM filling plant back in the 1950s, early 60s. So we've come a long way from that point in terms of PPE. In terms of site prep and training, on a conventional site, you'll have a magazine that you'll cite with fence and lightning protection. On a CWM site, you'll have an IHF, interim holding facility, and again, that has fencing and lightning protection. On a conventional site, usually about a half day of site-specific training. It's typically not too complicated. On a CWM site, the site-specific training may take up to 2 weeks, and this is team members running through different scenarios. Here we see training on a rescue operation. Here we see training in a decontamination station. So typically the team gets up and running and runs through scenarios for about 2 weeks. After they do that, Huntsville Corps of Engineers will conduct what's called a readiness review. This typically lasts about 3 days. Once the Huntsville team thinks everybody is prepared and ready, then there's a Department of Army pre-operational survey, and that lasts about 3 days. And this, the DA pre-op, typically you get a notice to proceed if everything falls in line in writing from the pre-operational survey to allow you to begin intrusive operations. Prior to intrusive operations actually beginning, there's what's called a tabletop exercise. This is another half day. This is a coordination meeting with local response agencies, police, fire, EMTs, whoever may be around. If you're on an active installation, certainly there's a lot of coordination with ongoing operations. And then there's also medical training. We had mentioned previously hospital staff and the ambulance staff receive about a day of medical training. Okay, so this is looking at various levels of PPE. You know, for both sites, there's really not a big difference typically for geophysics, as it is mostly non-intrusive. But when you do get to a CWM site, you have these various levels required for PPE. Modified level B is the kind of the lowest level. You'll see that in this picture over here. This person has what we call a slung mask. So within this bag is an air purifying respirator. So if something were to happen, they would move upwind and don that mask. Here's a group in level C, Tyvek and air purifying respirators, sealed off, gloves. And then ultimately, here's a level B operation where they have SCBAs and full Tyvek. And these Tyvek are rated to be chemical resistant as well. Other field operations considerations, we've mentioned the medical support a number of times, so anytime there's intrusive operations, you will have an ambulance. They, depending on what type of chemical agent you may be dealing with, they will have antidotes available to administer. And it's also important to keep in mind that the closest hospital may not necessarily have the capabilities to handle chemical agent casualty. So this goes in part of the planning process of identifying the correct hospital that's willing and capable of handling a chemical agent casualty. Air monitoring. So during the intrusive work, there is air monitoring at the intrusive location, and then there's also perimeter air monitoring that is conducted. This is typically done by a government agency. ECBC is what they were formerly known as, but then it became that mouthful of acronym that we discussed earlier. Here's a photo of what's called a miniature chemical agent monitoring system, and that is this black grouping of black lines that draw in air on a near continuous basis, run it here, and then by RF signal, we'll give the results back to someone outside the exclusion zone. So we can monitor in near real time what is happening at the intrusive site. And then this is called a DAMS, which is a depot area agent monitoring system. And within this black box is a pump, and it pulls air through a sorbent. And then at the end of the day, this box will be retrieved and analyzed. It's kind of a more precise assessment of if chemical agent was identified during operations. So shout out photo credit for this particular photo to our next presenter. This picture was actually taken by Clay Edmondson back in the day. Other considerations, other things for chemical sites, exclusion zones, engineering control structures, filtration system. So here's a filtration system that's attached to an IHF. If there was to be a release within the IHF, then agent would be contained within this chemical agent filtration system. Within this filter are multiple banks of activated carbon. So then when it comes out the stack, it has been scrubbed. So here's an example. Here's a figure of different exclusion zones. So here we looked at the hazard frag distance associated with these sites, and then we did an air dispersion model to identify the 1% lethality from these sites, and then ultimately maximum frag distance from these sites. So it's important to kind of lay all these out and make sure everyone understands the difference between, you know, here's an explosive release, here's a chemical agent release, and then another explosive release out here, and all the different distances involved. Handling and disposal, if you do find an item with suspect liquid filler, there are a couple of non-intrusive means to assess that. We talked earlier about X-ray. There's also an item called a PINS, and that helps identify what potentially the agent may be within an item. The data is then reviewed by a review board to see if they can make a determination on the contents. If they cannot make a positive determination on the contents, then you just assume the most hazardous chemical agent fill for that munition type. The item then gets packaged. Here is a picture of a team going through a packaging operation, typically placed in plastic. There's going to be vermiculite in here to stabilize it, and then placed into this container, and then ultimately transported and put into this interim holding facility, which is a secure facility, dual containment. Once an item is placed into an interim holding facility, then there are requirements for 24-hour security or an intruder detection system. Sampling and analysis. There is analytical methods that can be done for chemical agent. Usually what's done is on-site, a sample is collected, and there are three splits collected at that time. The first sample is analyzed on-site, and that is headspace analysis. If that particular sample is below action limits, then another split is sent off-site to a government laboratory for low-level extraction of chemical agent. And if there's no agent present or it's below the project action limits, then you can send a final split sample to a commercial laboratory if you want to look at perhaps metals or explosives results. You have to go through all of this first and notify the commercial lab, even though you've gone through all these steps, that there's still a possibility that the split sample may contain chemical agent. So that's an agreement that needs to be made with the lab in advance as well. Investigation derived waste. There are a whole lot of different waste streams that can be generated. Typically, you have bleach and decontamination solutions. If you do have a chemical agent filtration system, you have to dispose of those filter beds at the end. You may have munitions debris or range-related debris. Typically, this requires headspace analysis. the on-site laboratory, and they have cleaning solutions, sharps, the tubes that are analyzed on a daily basis. So these are all different lab stream waste streams. If you have an intact container that's not chemical agent, then that needs to be handled as hazardous waste. There are challenges with on-site demilitarization. So if you do have an intact item that's placed in the IHF, government agencies then come out to handle future demilitarization. That in itself may generate additional waste streams. And then ultimately, you may have chemical agent contaminated media that requires disposal. And depending on the concentration levels, it may need incineration. If the levels are low enough, you can opt for potentially landfill disposal. Here's a picture, whole long line of roll-offs filled with soil that had chemical agent in it. We were able to landfill this, but this is a very, very expensive disposal operation. This particular site, this was just a remedial investigation, and we generated this much soil because we were doing test pits. And the reason we have sites and large disposal ops is here's a picture from Spring Valley back in the day, and you can see there's an old pit right here, and they're just dumping chemical agent into the ground. So that's why we're out investigating these things. So closing out, reporting and project closeout, no major differences with final report requirements. They're typically, if it is a CWM job, your report just ends up being bigger. A lot of that is due to a lot of additional sampling, a lot of investigation-derived waste disposal, et cetera, et cetera. The risk analysis, similar risk analysis steps. There are some risk values associated with chemical agent, but even then, you know, there's a certain stigma associated with the presence of chemical agent. So the presence of any type of chemical agent may be considered unacceptable, regardless of what the risk analysis identifies. But, you know, again, things to consider when doing the final closeout report. Sometimes on CWM sites, you can do an extensive investigation and not find any chemical agent. Again, CWM sites tend to have a certain stigma about them. And if you don't find chemical agent, does that mean it's not there? It's difficult to prove the negative. This particular photo here was from a site. I mean, clearly they're dumping drums of chemical agent into the ground. Extensive sampling and investigation was done at this site, but no chemical agent was ever found. So during closeout, is that an acceptable response, or is it always a potential chemical agent site? Again, just something to consider in some of the differences between a conventional site and a CWM site. All right, so summary. The major differences are it's a lot more complicated for chemical sites. There are a lot more agencies involved. You know, you have state agencies, federal agencies, all sorts of government agencies for notification of CWM, disposal of CWM, et cetera. There are a lot more prescriptive requirements. You know, at the beginning we talked about that CWM Bible that steps you through all the steps that are required for chemical agent response. As you've seen, there's a lot more planning, a lot more plans that need to be developed. Training is a big aspect of chemical jobs, so it just takes a lot more front-end work. There tends to be much more public involvement. Normally when the public hears about a CWM investigation, there's more concern. As I've noted, there's certain stigma associated with CWM investigations, so that's another big difference. On-site personnel, a lot more folks involved with different tasks, a lot more moving parts, a lot more coordination. There's just the potential for a lot more unknowns. Disposal pits, testing sites, there are kind of one-off unique sites. for instance, at a place like Spring Valley, where it was kind of an agent development, there are all kinds of unknowns and things that keep popping up all the time. And lastly, there's the potential for greatly increased costs. Because of the disposal costs, the risks, the training, everything that's involved, your costs can amplify really, really quickly on a chemical site. So that's about it. Those are the major things. And thanks for listening. And I guess we'll open it up, Jeff, for questions.
Oh, thanks, Chris. We got time for one question. And would a site with potential buried CWM be handled as a CWM site with all the extra requirements and precautions?
It could be. Again, you'd have to go through that probability assessment, you know, how valid is the information regarding the burial of that CWM. If it's the probability is, you know, likely, occasional, frequent, then yes, you would have a CWM site. If the information you received might be just anecdotal or suspect, then you may be able to sign off that the likelihood of encountering it is seldom or unlikely. And then you would not have to handle it as a full-blown CWM site, but you would have to have in your APP an emergency response section. So if you did encounter CWM, the team would know to take the appropriate response to back off and then come back later and assess it as a CWM site.
Perfect. Thanks, Chris. Please just stay on the line sometime, and I'm sure we may have some other questions come down to you. And I think we're ready for our next presentation. That'll be Clay Edmondson from Tetra Tech, from agent contaminated to site closeout. And Clay, are you on the line?
Yes, sir. Give me just a few seconds for things to come up. Okay. Can you hear me, Jeff?
I can hear you.
Okay, good. Just to give you a little bit of information about myself, I'm the CWM Operations Manager at Tetra Tech. I graduated from North Carolina State University in 2002 with a degree in chemical engineering. A few months later, I found myself on the first CWM site at former Camp Seibert in Alabama. And over the past 17 years, I've been involved with over 30 CWM sites across more than 15 states and U.S. territories. When I started out, I started as a sample and waste management coordinator, moved up to assistant site manager and the site management, served as a technical manager, deputy project manager, and I'm currently a project manager also for Tetra Tech. I'm the project manager of CWM work I'll discuss here, SMU 13, Solid Waste Management Unit 13 at U.S. Army Pueblo Chemical Depot. And that's what my presentation's on, from agent contaminated to site closeout at SMU 13. As Chris alluded to, there are a lot of key participants on chem sites, the conventional sites as well, but there's a lot more involvement on your chem sites, the contracts come out of Huntsville Corps of Engineers. SMU 13 was funded, the work was funded by Army Environmental Command, And BRAC is also involved because portions of Pueblo Chemical Depot have already been transferred over to, transferring over to private ownership. We're in the Omaha District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, but there's some involvement from them. We're in Colorado, so the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment was our regulator we work with. Edgewood Chemical Biological Center does the chemical agent air monitoring as well as the soil sampling and analysis for, they do the analysis of the soil samples for chemical agent and agent breakdown product as well. As Chris mentioned, Edgewood Chemical Biological Center, ECBC, as they've been known for quite some time, recently changed their name, and their current name is Compact Capabilities Development Command. We also get support generally from Saboni Analytical and Remediation Activity. We know them more as CARA. It's a lot easier to say, but they generally run our personnel decontamination stations as well as do a more detailed assessment on any items we find that we feel might be suspect CWM if we identify it downrange. Again, I'm with Tetra Tech. We're the prime contractor on this contract. Parkview Medical Center was our primary hospital and trauma center and chemical agent hospital for response in case we did have any contamination of any personnel downrange. And also we had American, yes.
I'm so sorry, it's Jean. I just had a few requests. If it's either possible, I'm not sure if you're holding the handset or if you're on a speakerphone right now.
I'm on a headset.
You're on a headset. Is there any way we could physically pick up the handset and turn the headset off?
Is this any better?
I think that's going to be a lot better. I'm getting some messages in right now that sounds better. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you.
Okay, no worries. Thank you. Sorry about that. As I was saying, American Medical Response was our paramedics on site with the ambulance that would respond in case we did have any casualties downrange. They would be the first level of medical treatment to any personnel, and then they would, of course, transport to the hospital. The objective of the RCRA facility investigation at SMOOTH 13 was to conduct the RFI in accordance with Pueblo's RCRA Part B permit and, of course, all state of Colorado regulations. And the goal was to characterize any nature and extent of munitions and explosives of concern, or MEC. This also included chemical warfare material based on the suspected history at SMOOTH 13. We were to collect data to meet project data quality objectives as defined during the technical project planning process, or TPP meeting, and to perform human health and ecological baseline risk assessment. SMOOTH 13 required 100% characterization, sometimes known as a removal action, of an intrusive investigation to classify all materials disposed within the project site. So our job was to go in and dig everything up and assess what we were finding. When we left, we wanted to demonstrate that all chemical agent and agent breakdown products were below action levels established during the course of the project, and I confirmed this through confirmatory soil sampling once we felt like we were finished with the excavation and all material had been removed. Just to give you a little background on what we knew going into SMOOTH 13 or what we suspected going into SMOOTH 13, it was suspected to be the destruction site of intact leaking chemical bombs from 1942 to 1946. It was located on the eastern portion of Pueblo Chemical Depot in the middle of nowhere, an area, obviously, if you want to destroy chemical weapons, you want to kind of get away from any facilities or anything. So they found a spot on the eastern side of Pueblo Chemical Depot that they thought would be a good spot for getting rid of these items. Once they finished using the site, sometime after 1946, they did backfill the excavation with what was reported as clean backfill and fenced and posted the area to warn anybody from coming into that particular site. During our RFI, we did confirm the historical destruction of mustard field and lewisite field M70 115-pound chemical bombs at the site, and those are both blister agents. As Chris alluded to during his presentation, there's a lot of upfront activity just to get up off the ground. There's an initial mobilization and site setup. Generally, as I mentioned, when people are destroying these items, they're generally in the middle of nowhere, and so a lot of times they're in the middle of nowhere when we're doing these investigations. And so there's generally no infrastructure, any facilities, any power. So you basically have to go in the middle of nowhere and build a site out, office trailers, storage, containers, staging areas, road improvements. So there's a lot of upfront things that need to happen, and then you bring your personnel on site and train them running scenarios, preparing them for the activities coming up when they go intrusive. Following this, and again, as Chris mentioned, there are a series of inspections that we must pass before we're allowed to go in, intrusive. Those include the Huntsville survey. Once they are satisfied with the progress of the site, they pass it on to the Department of Army pre-operational survey that gives us our final inspection. And sometime between those two is a tabletop exercise, as Chris mentioned, where emergency responders in the area, people who are involved, local emergency staff are involved, and we sit around and do verbal scenarios of potential activities that could happen, chemical agent release, who do you call next, who responds, and gives them a confidence of what's going to happen in case something does happen downrange while the guys are working. After you get through that, you receive a notice to proceed. And we received ours on October 16th and began intrusive operations at Smooth 13 on October 16th. From October 16th through the 31st, what we did was remove the top layer of backfill soil off the area, and we dug down to about 3 to 5 feet across the total surface of the suspect area. And then after that, we focused on the northern portion of the site there with the red oval. We referred to that as the northern Alamos area, and we began to dig down there. On November 1st, we encountered our first two M70 bombs. They were empty, but they were suspected to have some residue in them, so they were packaged up and sent to the interim holding facility. I'll get more into that here in a minute. We continued operations and dug from 16 October through just before the beginning of December and completed the work in the northern area. In that red oval above, as I described, the northern anomalous area, we recovered 60 M70 bomb bodies. Seven of those were considered suspect CWM and were shipped and packaged and transported and safely secured in the interim holding facility we established at the site in bunker C510. We finished up the northern area just before our demobilization for the holidays in December, and we prepared the area for operations to excavate in the green area, the green circle down below that we refer to as the southern anomalous area. So when we return in January, we will begin operations there. When we returned in January, we thawed everything out and began getting back to work. We continued to work and prosecute that area, and we finished up the week of 12 February 2018. We recovered 15 additional M70 bomb bodies. After we completed excavation and removing all the material, we did do a DGM survey at the bottom of the excavation, which is magnetometers to cover the area to make sure there's no metal debris remaining. When we assessed that data, we did identify 18 small anomalies, the largest of which being 14.5 millivolts. So we're pretty happy with the prosecution of the anomalies. We investigated those 18 items. Some of them were no contacts just due to the general unevenness of the terrain while collecting the data, but we did find some nails, small pieces of metal, wire, and expended shotgun shell bases, but we did clear all that out. The next slide shows the DGM data on top of the original data, and you can see we did a good job of clearing out the anomalous areas. The area in yellow is the top of the excavation, the perimeter of the excavation, so we did fully prosecute and remove everything from the site. Following the excavation, we did confirmatory sampling. We collected soil samples at the bottom of the excavation, along the toe of the excavation, and collected 17 samples total, 12 of which were non-detect for chemical agent or agent breakdown products. We did have five with low-level detection of mustard agent breakdown product. The highest detection of 1,4-diethiene was 67 micrograms per kilogram, and the highest detection of 1,4-dioxane was 45 micrograms per kilogram. As you can see from the table down below, these are five orders of magnitude below our project action limits, so we're pretty safe, and we were allowed to eventually backfill the area. Just to give you a summary of what we accomplished during this investigation, we did remove 75 M70 bomb bodies, again, 60 from the northern anomalous area and 15 from the southern anomalous area. All 68 M70 bomb bodies that we kept in our possession that didn't go to the IHF were deformed, drummed, head-spaced, non-detect, or below vapor screening limits for requirements for a chemical agent, and they were ultimately shipped for incineration. The seven items that were assessed and put in the IHF as suspect CWM items were stored there until further assessment. In total, we filled 163 20-cubic yard roll-off boxes with soil. These were filled approximately halfway, and those are due to weight restrictions imposed when you're transporting these things on the road. Department of Transportation, as you're well aware, only has certain weight requirements for trucks. So we were only allowed to fill these boxes up halfway, but all told, we did approximately 2,000 tons of soil from the site. 61 of the roll-offs were characterized as non-hazardous and disposed of at a local approved landfill. This material came from the top layer we removed from the site, the first 3 feet. Other roll-offs were listed as hazardous waste by State of Colorado's K902 listing for chemical agent or potential chemical agent contaminated media. One roll-off box was shipped for incineration. It did have a reading of 1,200 micrograms per kilogram for mustard, so that was incinerated. The remaining roll-off boxes were approved to be shipped to a hazardous waste facility in Idaho for disposal. And ironically enough, the HTW analytical on all the soil samples came back as record non-hazardous, which chemical agent and agent breakdown products are part of the record family and are considered unregulated waste. The suspect CWM items, the M70s that were stored in the IHF, were further assessed by the Material Assessment Review Board. And five of the items were determined to be confirmed CWM because of mustard residue inside the items. And two of the other items were considered non-CWM because they either had water residue or were totally empty. All seven of these items were transferred to Pueblo's Chemical Limited Area on 23 June 2018, and all seven items were destroyed in the explosive destruction system located at Pueblo between the week of 10 to 16 July 2018. The 34 drums of M70 bomb bodies that we kept in our possession were again incinerated. We also collected 41 IDW drums of liquid that were shipped as hazardous waste for off-site disposal. This liquid was generated from the personnel decontamination station or deconning operations downrange for cleaning up items. And we also just disposed of 14 solid waste, including PPE and soil drums, that were also shipped as hazardous waste for off-site disposal. As part of the closeout operation, after receiving approval from the Colorado regulators, we did backfill the excavation. We used almost 2,200 tons of clean soil from a local borrower area and backfilled the Smooth 13 excavation. Completed operations on 11 June 2018. The final Smooth 13 RFI report was submitted on 8 February 2019, and a draft justification document for no further action at Smooth 13 was submitted on 17 May 2019. Ironically enough, we had the draft final of that report going out today for distribution as well. Some of the challenges we ran into on this site, there's always challenges on any site, but these are some of the ones that were sometimes shared on CWM sites, but were certainly front and center on this site. The condition of the rounds we found upon discovery was definitely challenging. Most of the CWM sites I've worked on in the past, and I think a lot of folks on this call have shared, you're generally dealing with either an intact round or a lot of scrap metal. These bombs were pretty well intact upon discovery, and had to be treated as intact until proven otherwise. So that did create some hiccups for us and schedule extensions to do the further assessments to determine you were dealing with either an empty round or, you know, is this a potential full intact round. Elevated PPE, as you might imagine, is always an issue when you're working in level C or B. You have mobility issues, vision issues, heat-related issues, so that's always a challenge when working on these sites. One of the other things we experienced was air monitoring times and clearance for PPE. Once PPE was cleaned downrange, when it was suspected to potentially be chemical agent contaminated downrange, all these items have to be submitted to the air monitoring team and cleared prior to reuse. Originally, we were running into backlogs where we weren't being able to get equipment out in time to send to the teams, and CARE was able to come in and support us with some additional equipment to give us a little breathing room between clearance times for reuse PPE. There were also access restrictions to Smooth 13. There was a small arms range down south of the site, and we were actually in the range safety fan. This was used by the base security guards to qualify from time to time. It was also used by local law enforcement and sometimes statewide law enforcement to qualify. They were really, really good working with us during this time frame, but there were certain time periods where they just couldn't turn off their schedule, and we had to either find something to do at Smooth 13
They didn't involve intrusive activities downrange, or we had to find something else to do. But it was a minimal impact, but it was somewhat of an impact to the schedule sometimes. There was also a decontamination requirement for some of these recovered bomb bodies based on the condition of them, as I mentioned. There was a possibility for entrapment of agent or agent contamination or residue or whatever. Some of these items could not be headspace cleared and required additional cleaning of the items in order to get them below the vapor screening limits in order for us to be able to ship them off range for disposal. Another unique problem to us, I've never experienced this before, but we did have our primary lab file bankruptcy during the project. We were able to capitulate and get another primary lab in place, but that was certainly an unanticipated challenge. Next up is our lessons confirmed. I call these lessons confirmed because none of these were really learned, but they were certainly reinforced during the course of this project. And I think most folks that have done this type of work previously are very well aware of these scenarios. But one of the things, because of all the key participants involved and the amount of communications that go out between organizations and agencies, you want to document conversations with follow-up emails or reports in order, you know, so there's an established record of what was decided. And it gives people opportunity also, in case you misunderstood something, to settle that and make sure all organizations on the same sheet of music. So it's always important to document conversations with follow-up emails or meeting minutes and such. Also, with your elevated PPE, you definitely want to make sure you have a strong heat stress monitoring program to avoid any heat casualties while you're working downrange. For this particular site, our time frame for heat casualties was mainly through the training phase, and then once we got past the training phase, we worked in colder weather, so you didn't have to monitor heat casualties so closely because it was ambient temperatures were so cold. But certainly during the training phase, we did have some folks that were getting worn and tired during the training process. So you always want to make sure you monitor, follow the heat stress monitoring program, and pay attention to your people. Another thing that's common on this site is waste tracking and disposal. You want to make sure you're constantly tracking and scheduling your waste for disposal because you're on a 90-day clock once you start generating waste. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen when you close a container. That's not when the clock begins. The clock begins on waste when you put the first grain of sand or the first drop of liquid in a container, and that's when it begins. So if you don't stay on top of that clock, especially when you're generating the amount of IDW that you would on a project like this, it can sneak up on you and bite you as far as getting that stuff off site. We didn't run into that scenario on the site, but it got close a few times, a little more close than I would like. And this is on my wish list and probably on most contractors' wish list, but I don't think it'll ever transpire. It would be nice to have additional contractor support on the site due to the competitive nature of this type of work. We find ourselves slashing and burning and only having the bare minimum amount of folks you have on site in order to win the contract. But it would certainly be nice at some point to have some additional folks on site to help out. That's all I had, Jeff. Do we have any time for any questions or discussion?
Oh, absolutely. All right. Let's see here. Let's pull up the first question we have. Can you explain the rationale behind analyzing for agent breakdown products?
Yeah, you would naturally assume that any agent or a chemical generally is going to break down over time. So the fact that you're finding agent breakdown products, you certainly confirmed that agent was there previously. And if you're finding agent breakdown product, you might want to continue to look because you may ultimately find chemical agent. And it does help to bolster what you've heard in the past that this site was potentially used for chemical agent destruction. You know for a fact that if you're finding agent breakdown product on the site, then indeed the story you heard and the reason you're out there is ultimately confirmed.
All right. Next question. Would the response be different if the SWMU-13 was within an active operational range?
Uh, Could you read that one more time? I want to make sure I understood that question.
Would the response be different if the SMU 13 was within an active operational range?
Oh, most certainly. Either the range would relent, or you couldn't do the work. obviously, if you know, you can't live fire while you have folks down range. We did kind of run into that situation, as I alluded to, with there being a small arms range just south of us, and us being in the range safety van. There was certain equipment we had to remove every afternoon in order to avoid it getting shot or hit with fire that was in the range safety van. I didn't mention this, but this was indeed the case while we were working SMU 13. Although they did shut down most days, they did still do training and qualifications after hours for us. So that did require us to move stuff off range. So, yeah, if you have an active range, obviously you're going to have to take that into account before you're doing any operations downrange.
All right, and one more question. Can Clay explain when the initial geophysics were performed and if this can be conducted prior to the long development work plans for the intrusive activities?
The original geophysics was performed in the 90s. I believe they did an investigation in 95 and 97 and part of our work before we went out there just to make sure everything was above board, because DGM has evolved quite a bit since the 90s. We did do another DGM survey prior to us doing this work so we could fine-tune where the anomalies were, where we needed to dig exactly. So we did conduct another DGM survey before this. The DGM survey at the bottom of the excavation was not really part of our scope, but we knew the regulators would want to see it. It would certainly bolster our claims that we did remove everything on site. So we did get inside the excavation and do follow-up DGM survey after the fact to bolster our case that the site was clean. Hope that answered the question.
All right, and that was the last question we have. And I think we'll go ahead and move on to Valentine Zingen. He's with Munirim. And his presentation is The State of the Science of Chemical Reduction and Oxidation of Chemical Agents. And Valentine, are you online?
Yes, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Gene, James, and Jeff for making this happen. I would like to talk about a topic that is fairly chemistry intensive. And so I hope everyone will bear with me when I get into some of the chemistry jargon. My name is Valentine Zingen. I am the Chief Technology Officer here at Munirim Environmental. I'm also a professor at the University of Georgia in Athens. I have spent about 25 years at the University of Georgia, and Munirim Environmental it's a fairly young company. We provide solutions for chemical neutralization of explosives. The product is in the market. Some firms are using the product to decontaminate buildings and also neutralize bulk explosives. The Munirim solution is owned by the University of Georgia, and we have the exclusive patent to commercialize the technology. Stay with me.
Yeah, you might need to click the arrow in the lower left on the screen first, and then your keyboard keys will work.
Okay. All right. It's working now. Thank you. Today I would like to cover about five different areas of the topic of chemical neutralization and destruction of chemical agents. I would like to first look at the current solutions and challenges, and then from there, look at what may be coming down the pipeline as alternative. Then look at a few case studies, one of them representing chemical oxidation and the other representing chemical reduction. I will end up with a summary and conclusion on where we are and where we may be going with this solution. When you take the literature, review it, look at what is going on in the area of chemical warfare, material remediation, and chemical agents deactivation and neutralization, most of the solutions focus on chemical oxidation. So I have a laundry list here of different chemical compounds that have been used to oxidize chemical warfare agents, including superchlorinated bleach, hydrolysis, which is very well known, supercritical water oxidation, electrochemical oxidation, activated persulfate. Some environmental remediation companies already use activated persulfate for other remediation purposes. And there is also the congreen, which is a chemical oxidant made of hydrogen peroxide mixed with carbonate. New to the area of chemical deactivation and neutralization is chemical reduction. In this area, we have metal catalysts that have been applied with some success, but there are still challenges. And then Minerem has formulations that have been evaluated and shown to have good promise. Of course, there is thermal destruction, which is very well known to the industry. I would like to focus on hydrolysis a little bit more in this presentation. That is because it's a technology that has been applied quite a bit in the field of remediation and destruction of bulk agents. Once I look at hydrolysis and some of the shortcomings, I would then make a few proposals on how we may overcome those limitations. Hydrolysis of chemical agent involves hot water and caustic. It works. It deactivates the agent and neutralizes the agent. Then there is also the activation with MEA, which is monoethanolamine and water. MEA has been used to deactivate and neutralize mustard, serine, and VX. And first, gin mostly is susceptible to aqueous sodium hydroxide neutralization. Hydrolysis, as I said earlier, works, but there are a few challenges. One is that it forms a transformation product, which is thiodiglycol, and so it is not mineralization of the agent. And this could pose a problem, because in some situations when the chemistry is not done under suitable conditions, some of the deactivated agents may be converted back to the neat agent. Then most agent, especially mustard, has impurities, a lot of impurities. Those impurities are not necessarily destroyed by hydrolysis. The pH tends to be very high of the end product or the investigator-derived waste. And as a result, the overall treatment byproducts must be disposed as hazardous waste, or there could be further treatment before disposal. The mere treatment which is applied in the EDS is also effective in deactivating chemical warfare agents. Unfortunately, the byproducts are toxic, and so they will have to be treated before disposal. In the presence of explosives, the mere treatment is challenged because it would not work that effectively on explosives. So these are two existing solutions for deactivation and neutralization of chemical warfare agents. They face some challenges, and as a result, there is need for something else if we can find it. So what would one like to see as a neutralant to neutralize and destroy chemical warfare agents? Some of the criteria may include a chemical formulation that will work over a wide range of temperatures and pH. It would be great if it is fast acting, because in the EDS application where MIA is used, the agent has to be destroyed 99.99% within 6 hours or in less than 6 hours. An effective reagent tool should destroy and not just transform the agent to an intermediary compound that can revert back to the need agent. And of course, the luxury of it all is that the end product should be non-hazardous, which should not give a lot of challenges in the disposal of the investigator-derived waste. I have looked at the different options and the chemistry that is required and what is promising. And sulfur oxides appear to be at the top of the list, and I will focus on them primarily in the remainder of the presentation. Sulfur oxides come in different formulations. Sulfur chemistry is very complex, because one form of sulfur oxide could be or is classified as chemical oxidants. The others are classified as chemical reductants. For example, activated persulfate oxidizes chemical warfare agents by producing sulfoxy-free radicals. Those free radicals attack the agent or the chemical agent and react very quickly. Another form of sulfur oxide, hydrosulfide, behaves as a chemical reductant. It also produces sulfoxy-free radicals, which will attack and destroy the agent. So these two options will be used as examples of chemical oxidants and chemical reductants, respectively. Let me look at the case of sulfoxy-free radicals generated from activated persulfate. This work has been done at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. The proof of concept bench scale test was done within the laboratory. The chemical reagents were activated persulfate used at 90 degrees Celsius to neutralize HD and other chemical agents. Based on the success of the bench scale test, the effective persulfate was converted into a gel. The reason for using a gel is that if one were decontaminating surfaces, there would not be splashing of the agent on the workers and on areas that have been decontaminated. So that was for ease of use and effectiveness. Based on the success of the bench scale test, the scientists at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory prepared the gel and went out to the field and carried out actual pilot tests and demonstration validation tests. The equipment that was used in the pilot tests was very simple. It's off-the-shelf equipment, commercially available equipment used for spraying paint. This is really convenient considering the fact that they are attacking a very challenging decontamination project. These are some of the results from the decontamination of chemical agents, three different chemical agents, mustard, G agents, and V agents. The detection limit on the mass gas chromatograph with mass spectrometer was 10 parts per million. On the left, sorry, I'm trying to get this to work. Okay. On the left is the percent extracted agent after decontamination with the air gel. On the x-axis, to the left, we have the 50 ppm standard that was used for comparison. The different surfaces were used. A blank here means it was used to destroy the agent in solution, then glass surface, painted steel, varnished wood, and then carpet. After the contamination, the surfaces were extracted and then analyzed for the agents, and you will see that it is good. It worked pretty well, very effective. Based on that success, the Lawrence Livermore National Lab went on to collaborate with different countries, the UK, the Czech Republic, and Edgewood Chemical Biological Forensic Analytical Center. And the three groups collaborated in field pilot tests, which I have shown here just the results from the test that was carried out in the Czech Republic. The baseline is hypochlorite treatment. And then this new material and old material simply means that the material that was fresh, neat agents, and aged agents. Compared to the baseline, you will see that the L gel worked pretty good. 98, 100% decontamination. And on the new material, not as effective, but poorly effective. An additional test was carried out with spores of agents. This is the initial concentration, which is the number of spores initially present. These are different surfaces. And you see that after the contamination, very few spores are left. This is the level of detection, the dotted line here. So 99.98% of the spores were neutralized and by the gel, by the decon gel. That was the case of chemical oxidation. I would like to talk next about chemical reduction using a product developed by Mirem. This case study was performed at Edgewood non-stockpile department. The neat agent was used in the proof of concept test. The image here shows the neat agent, and here to the right you see the aged agent, which is in solid form. In some cases they call it the heel. The neat agent was treated with Mirem reagent and allowed to incubate over 6 hours period. And the results you see here show the destruction of the agent, of the mustard, in this case mustard, after 1 hour, 3 hours, and 6 hours. The R01 and R02 that you see in the box, in the legend here, is at that time the Mirem formulation was made up of a combination of different formulations. It has since been improved and enhanced into one potent product, which reacts in the presence of water. So 1 hour in the samples here, this is the neat HD. Sand was put in as an impurity, metals, and then a combination of sand and metal. This was done to simulate what would happen if one were working with a neat agent and if the Mirem reagent was used to remediate HD in soils. You see that from 1 hour, 2, 3 to 6 hours, there was a significant destruction of the HD. Note that I'm using the term destruction here because I will qualify the word destruction rather than just neutralization in subsequent slides. A time course test was done, 1 hour, 3 hours, and 6 hours, with different concentrations of HD. 40 microliters need HD, 60 and 80 microliters. If you express that in terms of the volume of solution that was used, then you have 40 microliters equals to 9,000 parts per million, 60 equals to 14,000, and 80 microliters equals to 8,500 parts per million. A comparison was made with water and with MIA that is used in the EDF. In each case, you see a rapid destruction over a six-hour period using Minerim. And in the case of water and MIA, the term I'm going to use is neutralization or transformation. To qualify the use of the word destruction of HD by Minerim, the byproduct was monitored. The byproduct for the reaction is ethylene gas. At 1 hour, 3 hours, and 6 hours, you see an increase in the amount of ethylene gas that is formed and captured in the headspace. And when you compare Minerim, water, and MIA, you see a significantly higher concentration of ethylene gas in treatments with Minerim as compared to MIA and water. I would like to draw your attention to the fact that HD is a very impure chemical product. And so in this neat Minerim, in this neat mustard bulk material, there are impurities which I show here on the x-axis. So following the treatment, the headspace was analyzed. The ethylene gas, which is the byproduct, is shown for 1 hour, 3 hours, and 6 hours. And then the other impurities, such as benzene, 1 hour, 3 hours, and 6 hours, are also shown. So Minerim is not only destroying the mustard, but it is also reacting on some of the impurities that are present inside the product. Again, if you look at the other treatment that involve just the Minerim solution and agent, sand, metals, and mixture of metals and sand, you see that there is an increase in ethylene gas, which is confirmation of destruction of HD. If you're interested in chemistry and the reactions that are taking place, so you have reductive dechlorination taking place initially, the chlorine are knocked off. And once those chlorine are knocked off, then this bond between carbon and sulfur is broken or ruptured. And so you have ethylene, some sulfur, which in this case was iron sulfur, metal sulfide, iron sulfide, since iron was present, or sulfate. So this is what we believe is the pathway of that transformation or destruction reaction. Now I would like to shift and end up with what is happening in the real world. The EDS, the explosive destruction system, is used to neutralize agent. The Donovan chamber is also used, and for 1 ton container, thermal heating is used to decontaminate empty 1 ton steel containers. If one were to add Minerim or the other chemical oxidants or chemical oxidants to the list of solutions. We envision a flow chart where the containers are moved into the secured area. And then there is sorry, I lost connection here at my end. Okay, I got it back. So the container is moved from storage, the containers are drained, and the liquid agents can be neutralized with Miriam reagents while the empty container is decontaminated in a bath that contains Miriam solution. Bear with me, I lost connection and I'm trying to get my functions back. I can't get my pointer back for some reason.
It's pointer's right there, and if you need let me know.
All right, okay. So the metal component is decontaminated with Minerim, and then the bulk agent can be destroyed in a reactor. And so this is just another flow chart giving different options. With that in mind, if one were to neutralize the contents of a one-ton container and decontaminate the container, it could be done in the closed-loop system. So the diagram here is just showing that closed-loop system that introduces, that disrupts or breaches the ton container and then injects the Miriam reagent into the ton container, and the agent is recovered and destroyed. We are collaborating with another company in developing this model so that it can be applied in the form of a backpack that anchors to this one-ton container, extracts the agent, neutralizes it, monitors what is going on, and then once it is verified that neutralization has taken place, the system can then be opened up and inspected. This is a project that is in the development stage, so there is nothing concrete now that I can present on the actual performance or performance data that does exist. And I believe that that concept should be proven within the next 5 years or so. In concluding, I would like to say that chemical neutralization of chemical warfare agents to non-hazardous waste is feasible. Sulfur oxides are most promising in neutralizing chemical warfare agents. We have developed an optimized Miriam reagent that can work as well as the chemical oxidants that has been proven by Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. If chemical neutralization and destruction by chemical oxidants and chemical reductants are embraced, the neutralants will reduce the cost, especially the capital cost of remediation of soils and demill of chemical warfare agents or chemical warfare material. Thank you very much. Thank you for your attention. And I'll be glad to answer questions.
All right. Thank you, Valentine. Let me see here if we got, looks like we've got one, let's see here. That's for Clay. And I think we do not have any questions at this time. So, Gene, if you could pull up the last slide for of mine.
Okay, Jeff, you should have your slide up with the 2020 list of sessions.
Oh, there it finally comes up. Sorry, I've got a little lag time. I'm working from home today. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate you joining us today for our webinar. And 2020 sessions will be coming out later on in next fiscal year. These are some of the selections we may be putting out. They are subject to change, but it looks like we're going to do practice munitions, spotting charges, risk and case studies. We've had a lot of projects with those on it. Policy and regulation updates. We're having a lot of changes to policies and regulations this year. And we're doing a couple special ones, FSs, that's feasibility studies from start to finish, and DADCAP, lessons learned. That is AGC, Advanced Geophysics Classification. That has been some of the major stuff coming out with in the industry with technology. And we've had a lot of time out there, so we decided to put something out, let you know what we've learned and what we haven't learned. If you've missed any of our presentations in the past, you can find them at the address shown up on the screen. And with that, I think I am done, unless we have anything else from you, Gene.
Well, thank you. I'm just going to walk through a very quick set of housekeeping items and reminder messages before we officially close out today's live broadcast. So the first thing that I want to do is just to remind everybody, if they're not already subscribed, we do have a free monthly newsletter called Tech Direct that goes out on the first of the month. You'll find it at cluin.org. If you'd like to be informed of future sessions like this one, as well as many others in the area of cleaning up hazardous waste sites, I strongly encourage you to sign up for that free newsletter. Copies of the presentation materials are already available to download as PDFs, so you'll find those on the resources or links page. If you look on the middle right of your screen under the related URLs window, there is a link to seminar resources. Just click it to select it and then press the Browse To button to open it on up. For those of you replaying the recorded version, you can still follow those links on the middle right. I would ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Now, one of the most common questions I usually get is if you can get a certificate for joining us, and yes, you can if you fill out that feedback form. So when you're following the link to the feedback form, again, you'll find that on the right side of your screen, be sure to fill the form out completely and check the box at the very bottom to certify you were here for the entire live event, or if you watched it, you replayed the entire archived version. As long as your email address is entered correctly on that form, as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then have immediate access to a certificate that you can either save or print out for your own records. If you join together as a group, each person can fill that feedback form out on their own, even if you didn't register individually. So if you are in a conference room with others, please be sure to share that URL to the feedback form with those in the room with you so they can get their own certificates. Specifically, when you fill out that form, I know that we tried a few new techniques in today's webinar, including new ways to join to try to make things easier for some of our Department of Defense participants. So I welcome your feedback on some of those changes you may have seen. Good or bad, we are always trying to improve the delivery. So with that, I want to thank all of the speakers and organizers who took time out of their busy days to share their information today, as well as for Jeff for joining us as a moderator. I also want to thank the nearly 100 individuals who joined us from across the U.S. for today's session. And as Jeff noted, I hope that you'll be with us for future deliveries here as part of the M2S2 series on CLUIN. So with that, today's session was recorded. You'll get an email with information on how you can replay it in approximately 1 week. And with that, I will go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for